Taken under advisement in the Aricia versus Battaglia case, Mr. Kamik. Is that Mr. Kamik?
May it please the court, counsel, I'm David Kamik. I represent Joseph Ferrietta. Briefly, what we are asking this court to do is reverse the district court on the dismissal of his 2254 petition. The appellate court previously decided the case of Newell v. Hanks. In that case, the court indicated that there should be mandatory equitable tolling when there's a mixed 2254 petition. And followed by a voluntary motion to dismiss. I want to just very, very briefly talk about just a brief history. The 2254 petition was filed June 23, 1999. At the time, there was no petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. As the district court decision noted, that was probably because the inmate was relying on Borkel v. O'Sullivan. When that was reversed, then the inmate goes back to state court seeking further relief. November 4th, 99, the Illinois Supreme Court denies his motion. Petitioner goes to file again, and then Apprendi is decided. And October 16th, 2000, the petitioner files another pro se motion to dismiss following Apprendi, suggesting that he's going back to the state court to file a new petition, and that petition was actually pending for an incredibly long period of time. When it was finally dismissed, he then files a pro se motion to reinstate.
Did you say it was voluntarily dismissed, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
He then files a pro se motion to reinstate at simultaneously filing a new petition. That was ultimately dismissed as untimely. And if you recall in Newell, what happened was there was a mixed petition that was filed. Mr. Newell's, through counsel, took a voluntary dismissal without prejudice. It was then refiled when the state claims were exhausted. At that time, the district court in Indiana indicated it was untimely. It comes to the Seventh Circuit, and they indicated that in this type of analysis, the petition should really be told and relate back to the original filing. And that's what we're asking you to do, although we concede that Mr. Arrieta's petition was not a mixed petition. However, we believe this is the appropriate way to handle the 2254 petitions when there's clear evidence of a voluntary motion to dismiss, whether the petition is mixed or not, because the equitable principles that were applied in the Newell case should apply regardless if it's a mixed case or a non-mixed case. Interestingly, Palmer versus Carlton, as we cited in our brief, which is a Sixth Circuit case, and in Zarvella, this is R2, is a Second Circuit, again, on mixed petition, has adapted a mandatory tolling provision, and we believe that would be most appropriate, particularly when in the Second Circuit they've laid out a neat time frame wherein you've got 30 days following the voluntary non-suit to finish up your state claims, and then 30 days from the end of those to go back to the district court. It would seem to us that that's the type of procedure that would accomplish what 2254 really seeks to accomplish, and that is to allow inmates to seek relief from the federal court. In this case in particular, if you look at the history of it, obviously what this inmate was trying to do was not file a mixed claim. And because he's trying not to file a mixed claim, he takes successive non-suits. He files a new claim, realizes there's something else he should raise in the state court. He asks to voluntarily dismiss it again. And finally, when he believes they're all through, is when he files the petition that says he's time barred. If he had filed the mixed claim originally under Newell, he probably would not be time barred. And what we're suggesting is the appropriate way to handle this is when it's clear on its face that what he is trying to do is comply with the law as it is at the time he's filing, keeping in mind the reversal in O'Sullivan and then later Apprendi, where the law is developing very quickly, we think you should apply mandatory equitable estoppel. And as a second argument, we'd like you to consider, we meaning the petitioner would like you to consider the Rule 60B6 equitable relief. And again, this is based entirely on what the gentleman did while he was in the Department of Corrections, attempting to comply with the law. It is, he clearly wasn't trying to use the expression game the system. He was trying to comply with the rules. He was trying to comply with the ever-changing nature of the law in this area. And because he apparently did a pretty good job for a jailhouse lawyer, didn't file a mixed petition and kept trying to avoid a mixed petition, we think in this case the equitable principles in 60B6, because obviously one doesn't apply, 60B6 should apply, and that you should reverse the district court's dismissal and allow him to proceed on the habeas petition. And with that, I will rely on the written brief.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Saunders.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Catherine Saunders. I'm an assistant attorney general from the Illinois.
If you reach under there, there's a little button that will raise the platform so that you can speak more clearly.
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, you may be fine, but I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Reach underneath, under your left, your right hand, left hand. Go ahead. Give the lady some assistance.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I don't think so.
It doesn't work.
Would you turn it off?
Well, perhaps just lift this, if you would.
Thanks. There we go. I knew there was a solution to the problem. Carry on. You have a low, well-modulated voice, but...
Again, I'm Assistant Attorney General Catherine Saunders from the Illinois Attorney General's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent warden in this case. Dismissal of petitioner's second habeas petition as untimely was entirely proper, as I'll demonstrate. First of all, the dismissal of his first petition was proper. Petitioner, as counsel indicated, filed a timely first habeas petition immediately after, or nearly immediately after, sought to return to state court to seek leave to file a late PLA to cure the default of his post-conviction claims. So it was entirely reasonable then when petitioner came back to federal court and asked the court to voluntarily dismiss his petition without prejudice. It's based on the course of conduct, it was reasonable for the judge to conclude that when petitioner wanted a stay, he asked for a stay, and when he wanted to voluntarily dismiss without prejudice, he must have meant something different. And we know from Plyler v. Ford that the court has no duty to warn a petitioner. He doesn't have the district court judge doesn't have a duty to calculate the statute of limitations or warn a petitioner about the impending limitations period ending. The mandatory equitable tolling cases cited by petitioner are really inapposite here. First of all, because this was not a mixed petition, but more importantly, those policy concerns are not applicable here. In the mandatory equitable tolling cases and in Rhines, what the court is worried about is the interplay between Rose v. Lundy, which says the court must dismiss a mixed petition, and the one-year statute of limitations that came in under the AEDPA 14 years later. So what the court is worried about is that petitioners are coming to federal court with a mixed petition either near the end of the limitations period or that the exhaustion determination is being made after the limitations period is run. And then when the federal district court dismisses this petition pursuant to Rose v. Lundy, that the court is depriving the habeas petitioner of his federal collateral challenge. But here that's not the case. Here petitioner voluntarily sought a dismissal without prejudice. which is proper under Plyler, absent any allegation, and here there is none, that he was misled in any way. And to the extent Newell and these mandatory equitable tolling cases say that a district court must always stay the petition, that holding has been markedly limited by the recent case of Rines v. Weber, which says that a district court does have discretion to stay a petition, but only in certain limited circumstances. The petitioner here is not entitled to 60B relief, and the district court properly so found. Petitioner's claim is properly characterized as one pursuant to 60B1 of mistake. It was a mistake to dismiss that first petition after the limitations period had already run. It was a mistake when he dismissed it for that very reason, because at that point the limitations period had run and he could no longer file a timely petition. And there's a one-year time limit on a 60B1 relief, and you cannot circumvent that one-year time limit by seeking the same relief under 60B6 or the catch-all. Petitioner has argued that Newell was, in effect, a change in the law that it would allow 60B6 relief, but intervening developments in the law by themselves is just a change in the interpretation, do not constitute the extraordinary circumstances that would warrant 60B6 relief. And in 60B6 situation where the courts have granted relief, a petitioner or a litigant, there's just simply no way the petitioner or the litigant could have discovered in time the reason to vacate the judgment. Although voluntary dismissal of his first petition, in hindsight, was a mistake. I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing.
I just need a clarification of the procedural record here. The petitioner never sought leave to amend the petition once he came back from state court in order to add the additional claims, thereby making this effectively a mixed petition. He simply moved to dismiss so that he could go back again to state court on the additional claims he wanted to raise.
I'm sorry, I am hard of hearing. I understood your question to be, should he have amended his petition first?
No. Did he seek leave to amend in order to add the new claims after he came back to federal court from state court, or did he simply move to dismiss in order to go back to state court?
He filed a motion, yes, seeking leave to dismiss. He didn't say what he wanted to raise, but he did say he would like to amend his petition. But before respondent could respond to that or before the court could answer that, then he filed his motion to voluntarily dismiss without prejudice. Yeah. Moving briefly to the merits of petitioner's constitutional claims, it's respondent's position that petitioner's failure to brief the two certified constitutional claims should result in a forfeiture of those claims pursuant to this court's precedent in Anderson v. Litcher. But if the court should conclude the petitioner has not forfeited his claims, the court should not address his constitutional claims in this appeal. First, because the district court did not consider these claims on the merits, and because the dismissal was a Rule 4 dismissal, respondent didn't have the opportunity to provide the Rule 5 materials, which typically make up the bulk of the record in a federal habeas case. In closing, if there are no further questions, respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm the judgment of the district court dismissing the petition as untimely.
Thank you, Ms. Saunders. Mr. Kim?
Briefly, let me concede, we did not brief the constitutional claims until the reply brief. Essentially, I'll concede, because the record was so sparse, it didn't occur to us until the reply brief, and we did address them then, and we would agree that it wouldn't be appropriate to resolve the constitutional claims because we were here on a procedural issue, and procedural issues, as the court's well aware, have to be dealt with first in either event. The petitioner did not, to answer your last question, the petitioner did not, if memory serves me, never, he asked leave to amend, but the only amendment he filed was not really an amendment, but motion, what he called a motion to reinstate with a new petition. And what we're trying to do is have Newell apply both to mixed and non-mixed petitions. And what is interesting, and I'll be very brief on this point, is the district court seemed to say that I can tell why he voluntarily non-sued his first position, because he was relying on the original Sullivan case. And then when it was reversed, the district court could intuitively determine what the relief the petitioner was trying to seek. And what we're suggesting, if you can intuitively do that, and we think district courts are pretty clear when you read this, then you can tell that what he really wasn't trying to do was to dismiss his case, but to put a hold on it, to stay it, to toll it. And we're asking that his petition be tolled and then allow his case to be heard. That's simply it, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.
I think he was appointed.